The Trial by Franz Kafka, continued, Disc 4.
On some occasions, initial petitions were not even read by the court. They were simply put in the file with a note that, for the time being, the hearings and surveillance of the accused were much more important than anything put in writing. If the petitioner pressed the issue, it was added that once all the evidence had been collected, and prior to the verdict, this first petition would be considered as well, together with all other documents, of course. Unfortunately, that wasn't true either in most cases. The first petition was generally misplaced or completely lost, and even if it was retained to the very end, the lawyer had only heard this by way of rumour, of course, it was scarcely even glanced at. All that was regrettable, but not entirely without justification. K must not overlook the fact that the proceedings are not public. They can be made public if the court considers it necessary, but the law does not insist upon it. As a result, the court records and, above all, the writ of indictment are not available to the accused and his defence lawyers, so that in general it's not known, or not known precisely, what the first petition should be directed against, and for that reason it can only be by chance that it contains something of importance to the case. Truly pertinent and reasoned petitions can only be devised later, when, in the course of the defendant's interrogations, the individual points of the indictment and its basis emerge more clearly, or may be surmised. Under these conditions, the defence is naturally placed in a very unfavourable and difficult position. But that, too, is intentional, for the defence is not actually countenanced by the law, but only tolerated. And there is even some controversy as to whether the relevant passages of the law can truly be construed to include even such tolerance. In the strict sense, therefore, there are no court-recognised lawyers. All those who appear before the court as lawyers are basically shysters. Of course, that has an extremely degrading effect upon the entire profession, and the next time Kay went to the law court offices, he should take a look at the lawyer's room. That was quite a sight, too. He would probably be shocked by the lot gathered there. The narrow, low room to which they were relegated was in itself an indication of the court's contempt for these people.
Light enters the room only through a small hatch so high up that if someone wants to look out, and incidentally get a nose full of smoke and a sooty face from the chimney just outside, he first has to find a colleague who will hoist him up on his back. For over a year now, to give just one more example of the poor conditions, there's been a hole in the floor of the room. Not large enough for a person to fall through, but big enough that one whole leg can sink in. The lawyer's room is in the upper level of the attic, so if someone slips through, his leg hangs down into the lower level, right into the hall where the parties are waiting. It's no exaggeration when such conditions are described in lawyers' circles as scandalous. Complaints to the administration don't have the slightest effect, yet lawyers are strictly forbidden from changing anything in the room at their own expense. But there's a reason they treat lawyers this way. They want to eliminate the defence as far as possible. Everything is to be laid upon the defendant himself. Basically, that's not a bad position to take, but nothing would be more mistaken than to conclude from it that defendants have no need of lawyers before this court. On the contrary, there is no other court before which there is a greater need. For in general, the proceedings are kept secret not only from the public, but from the accused as well. Only insofar as possible, of course, but to a very large extent it does prove possible. For even the accused has no access to the court records, and it's very difficult to ascertain during the interrogations which documents are involved, particularly for the defendant, who after all is timid and disconcerted and distracted by all sorts of cares. This is where the defence enters in. In general, defence lawyers are not allowed to be present at the interrogations, and so must question the defendant about an interrogation immediately upon its conclusion, if at all possible at the very door of the inquiry room, and deduce from the defendant's often quite hazy accounts whatever might be of use to the defence. But that's not what's most important, since not much can be learned that way, though even here, as elsewhere, a skilful person can learn more than others. Nevertheless, the most important factor is still the lawyer's personal contacts. They are the most valuable aspect of a defence. Now, Kay had no doubt already learned from his own experience that the lowest level of the court system is not entirely perfect, that it includes some employees who forget their duty and can be bribed, which in turn produces breaches, so to speak, in the strictly closed system of the court. Now, this is where the majority of lawyers push their way in, bribing people and pumping them for information. In fact, in earlier days, there were even cases of stolen files. There's no denying a few momentary and even surprisingly positive results can be achieved on the defendant's behalf by such means, and petty lawyers parade them proudly to lure new customers. But as far as the future progress of the trial is concerned, they're meaningless or worse. Only honest personal contacts are of true value, and with higher officials, by which is meant, of course, higher officials from the lower ranks. This is the sole means by which the progress of the trial can be influenced, imperceptibly at first, but more and more clearly as it moves along. Only a few lawyers can do that, of course, and here Kay's choice had been fortunate indeed. There were only one or two lawyers who might possibly match Dr. Hould's contacts. Of course, these paid no attention to the lot in the lawyers' room and had nothing to do with them. Their ties to the court officials, however, were correspondingly stronger. It wasn't even always necessary for Dr. Hould to go to court, wait in the outer offices for the chance appearance of examining magistrates, and then, according to their mood, achieve what was generally a merely apparent success, and perhaps not even that. No, as Kay had seen himself, officials, and relatively high ones at that, came to him, offered information willingly that was clear, or at least easily interpreted, discussed the recent progress of the trial, indeed, in some cases, even allowed themselves to be convinced, gladly taking on the other's point of view. Of course, one didn't dare trust them too far with respect to this latter trait. No matter how decisively they state their new intent, which is favourable to the defence, they may well go straight to their office and issue a decision for the next day that conveys the exact opposite, and is perhaps even more severe with respect to the defendant than that which they had at first intended, and which they claimed to have entirely abandoned. Of course, there was no way to protect oneself against that, for what was said in private conversation was exactly that, a private conversation with no public consequences, even if the defence had not been otherwise constrained to retain the favour of those gentlemen. On the other hand, of course, it was also true that these gentlemen were not moved simply by humanitarianism or feelings of personal friendship to establish contact with the defence, only a competent one, naturally, but did so because they were, in a certain sense, dependent upon them. Here, the disadvantage of a court system that was grounded from its very beginnings in secrecy came to the fore. The officials lacked contact with the common people. They're well prepared for the normal, average trial, which rolls along its course almost on its own and needs only a push now and then, but faced with very simple cases, or with particularly complex ones, they're often at a loss. Because they're constantly constricted by the law both night and day, they have no proper understanding of human relationships, and in such cases they feel that lack keenly. Then they come to the lawyer for advice, and behind them comes an assistant carrying the files, which are otherwise so secret. Many a gentleman one would least expect to find in such a situation might be discovered at this very window, gazing almost hopelessly out into the street, while at his desk the lawyer studies the files to offer his advice. Moreover, one could see at such times how uncommonly seriously these gentlemen took their profession, and into what great despair they were thrown when, due to the very nature of the obstacles, they could not overcome them. In other ways, too, their position is no easy one, nor should one do them the injustice of regarding it as such. The gradations and ranks of the court are infinite, extending beyond the ken even of initiates. The proceedings in the courts of law are generally a mystery to the lower officials as well. Therefore, they can almost never follow the progress of the cases they are working on throughout their course. The case enters their field of vision, often they know not whence, and continues on, they know not where. The lessons to be learned from the study of the individual stages of a trial, the final verdict and its basis, are lost to these officials. Their involvement is limited to that part of the trial circumscribed for them by the law, and they generally know less about what follows, and thus about the results of their own efforts, than the defence, which, as a rule, remains in contact with the accused almost to the very end of the trial. So, in this respect, too, they can occasionally learn something of value from the defence. Was Kay still surprised, then, bearing all this in mind, at the irritability of the officials, which sometimes expressed itself, as everyone soon learned, in an insulting manner toward the parties involved? All officials are irritable, even when they appear calm. Of course, the petty lawyers suffer in particular from this. For instance, the following story is told, and has every appearance of truth. An elderly official, a decent, quiet gentleman, had studied a difficult case, rendered particularly complex due to the lawyer's petitions, for one entire day and night without a break. These officials are truly the most industrious of people. Now, as morning approached, after 24 hours of probably not very productive work, he went to the outer door, waited in ambush, and threw every lawyer who tried to enter down the steps. The lawyers gathered on the landing below and discussed what they should do. On the one hand, they have no real right to be admitted, so they can hardly start legal proceedings against the official, and, as already mentioned, they have to be careful not to arouse the ire of the bureaucracy. On the other hand, each day missed at court is a day lost, so it was important to them to get in. Finally, they decided to try to wear the old gentleman down. One lawyer at a time would rush up the stairs and, offering the greatest possible passive resistance, allow himself to be thrown back down, where he would then be caught by his colleagues. That lasted for about an hour. Then the old gentleman, who was already tired from working all night, grew truly exhausted and went back into his office. At first, those below could hardly believe it, so they sent someone up to check behind the door to make sure there was really no one there. Only then did they enter, probably not even daring to grumble, for the lawyers, and even the least important of them has at least a partial overview of the circumstances, are far from wishing to introduce or carry out any sort of improvement in the court system while, and this is quite characteristic, almost every defendant, even the most simple-minded among them, starts thinking up suggestions for improvement from the moment the trial starts, and in doing so often wastes time and energy that would be better spent in other ways. The only proper approach is to learn to accept existing conditions. Even if it were possible to improve specific details, which, however, is merely an absurd superstition, one would have at best achieved something for future cases, while in the process damaging oneself immeasurably by having attracted the attention of an always vengeful bureaucracy. Just don't attract attention. Keep calm, no matter how much it seems counter to good sense. Try to realize that this vast judicial organism remains, so to speak, in a state of eternal equilibrium, and that if you change something on your own where you are, you can cut the ground out from under your own feet and fall, while the vast organism easily compensates for the minor disturbance at some other spot. After all, everything is interconnected and remains unchanged, if not, which is more likely, even more resolute, more vigilant, more severe, more malicious. One should leave the task to the lawyers instead of interfering with them. Reproaches are of little value, particularly when it seems the full import of what has caused them cannot be conveyed. But he must say how much Kay had hurt his own affair by his behaviour toward the chief clerk of the court. This influential man must almost certainly be crossed off the list of those to whom one might turn on Kay's behalf. He pointedly refused to acknowledge even passing references to Kay's trial. In many ways, the officials were like children. They were often so hurt by seemingly minor matters, though Kay's behaviour, unfortunately, did not fall into that category, that they stopped speaking even with close friends, turning aside when they met them, and opposing them in every possible way. But then, surprisingly and for no apparent reason, they would allow themselves a laugh at some small joke, attempted only because the situation seemed so hopeless, and were reconciled once more. It was both difficult and easy to relate to them. There were hardly any guidelines to go by. Sometimes it seemed amazing that an average lifetime sufficed to learn enough to work here with a modicum of success. Of course, there are always dark hours, everyone has them, when it seems that one has accomplished nothing, when it seems as if the only trials that turned out well were those that were destined to do so from the very beginning, without any help at all, while all the others were lost in spite of following them so closely, in spite of all the effort, all the small apparent victories that gave such pleasure. Then, of course, nothing seems certain any longer. And if pressed specifically, one does not even dare deny that trials that by nature should have turned out well were thrown off course precisely by the assistance offered. That, too, is a type of belief in oneself after all, but it is the only sort that remains. Lawyers are particularly susceptible to such attacks. They are, of course, mere attacks and nothing more, when a trial they have conducted satisfactorily up to a certain point is suddenly taken out of their hands. That's probably the worst thing that can happen to a lawyer. It's not the defendant who takes the trial from them. Indeed, that probably never happens. Once a defendant has engaged a particular lawyer, he has to stick with him no matter what. How could he possibly sustain himself alone once he has enlisted aid? So that doesn't happen. But it does indeed sometimes happen that the trial takes a direction the lawyer is not permitted to follow. The trial, the defendant, everything is simply withdrawn from the lawyer. In that case, the best of connections with the officials are of no use, for they themselves know nothing. The trial has entered a stage where no further assistance can be given. where it is being handled by inaccessible courts of law, where even the defendant is no longer within reach of the lawyer. Then you come home one day to find on your desk all the many petitions you submitted so diligently and with such great hopes in the case. They've been returned. Since they can't be transferred to the new stage of the trial, they're worthless scraps of paper. But that doesn't mean the trial has been lost, not by any means, or at any rate there is no definitive reason to assume so. One simply knows nothing more about the trial and won't learn anything more either. But fortunately such cases are exceptions, and even should Kay's trial turn out to be one of them, it was still far removed from such a stage at the moment. So there was still ample opportunity for the lawyer to take action, and Kay could rest assured that those opportunities would be seized. As he had mentioned, the petition had not yet been submitted, but there was no hurry about that. The preliminary discussions with the officials in charge were of much greater importance, and those had already taken place. With varying degrees of success, it must be frankly admitted. It was far better for the time being not to reveal details which might only affect Kay unfavourably and make him overly hopeful or all too anxious. Suffice it to say that some of them had responded quite favourably and proved quite cooperative, while others had responded less favourably, while by no means refusing their assistance. The results were thus, on the whole, quite gratifying, although one mustn't draw too many conclusions from them, since preliminary proceedings always started out that way, and only further developments would reveal their true value. At any rate, nothing was lost as yet, and if it still proved possible to win over the chief clerk of the court in spite of everything, various steps had already been taken toward that end, then the whole matter, as the surgeons say, was a clean wound and one could await what was to follow with confidence. In such and similar speeches the lawyer was inexhaustible. They were repeated at every visit. Progress had always been made, but the nature of this progress could never be specified. He was always at work on the first petition, but it was never finished, which generally proved at the next visit to have been a major advantage, since the last time, and there had been no way of foreseeing this, the circumstances had been quite unfavourable for its submission. If, on occasion, exhausted by these speeches, Kay remarked that even considering all the difficulties, things seemed to be progressing quite slowly, he received the rejoinder that the progress was not at all slow, but that things would doubtless be much further along had Kay contacted the lawyer in a timely manner. Unfortunately, he had neglected to do so, and this failure would result in further disadvantages, and not merely temporal ones. The only welcome interruption during these visits was Lenny, who always knew how to arrange things so that she served the lawyer's tea in Kay's presence. Then she would stand behind Kay, apparently watching the lawyer as he bowed deeply over his cup, almost greedily, to pour his tea and drink it, while she secretly allowed Kay to grasp her hand. Total silence reigned. The lawyer drank, Kay squeezed Lenny's hand, and Lenny sometimes dared to stroke Kay's hair softly. "You're still here?" asked the lawyer when he had finished.
"I wanted to clear away the dishes,"
said Lenny. There was a last squeeze of the hand. The lawyer wiped his mouth and started speaking to Kay again with renewed vigour. Was it consolation or despair the lawyer sought to produce? Kay didn't know, but he soon held it for an established fact that his defence was not in good hands. Everything the lawyer said might be true, although it was transparently clear he was primarily interested in emphasizing his own role and had probably never had a trial as important as he considered Kay's to be. But the constant emphasis on his personal contact with officials remained suspicious. Were they being exploited solely to Kay's advantage? The lawyer never failed to remark that these were only lower-level officials, officials who were thus themselves in a position of dependence, and for whose advancement certain developments in the trials might presumably be of importance. Were they perhaps using the lawyer to effect such developments, which would, of course, be to the defendant's disadvantage? Perhaps they didn't do so in every trial, that would be unlikely. There were probably other trials in the course of which they allowed the lawyer certain advantages in exchange for his services, since they surely wished to maintain his good reputation undamaged. If that's how things really stood, however, what tack would they take in Kay's trial, which, as the lawyer explained, was a very difficult and important one that had excited a great deal of attention at court from the very start? There couldn't be much doubt about what they would do. Signs of it could already be seen in the fact that the first petition had still not been submitted, although the trial had already lasted for months, and that, according to the lawyer, everything was still in the beginning stages, which was, of course, admirably suited to lull the defendant to sleep and keep him in a state of helplessness, so that they could assault him suddenly with the verdict,
or at least announced that the inquiry had concluded unfavourably for him and was being passed on to higher administrative authorities. It was absolutely necessary for Kay to intervene personally. It was precisely in states of extreme fatigue, as on this winter morning, when his thoughts were drifting aimlessly, that this conclusion seemed most inescapable. The contempt he had previously borne for the trial no longer applied. If he had been alone in the world, he could have easily disregarded the trial, although then the trial would surely never have occurred at all. But now his uncle had already taken him to the lawyer, and family considerations were involved. His job was no longer totally independent of the course of the trial. He himself had been incautious enough to mention the trial to a few acquaintances with a certain inexplicable feeling of self-satisfaction. Others had heard about it in unknown ways. His relationship to Fräulein Bürstner seemed to fluctuate with the trial itself. In short, it was no longer a matter of accepting or rejecting the trial. He was in the midst of it and had to defend himself. If he was tired, he was in trouble. There was, of course, no reason to be overly concerned for the time being. He had managed to work his way up to a high position in the bank in a relatively short period of time and, respected by all, maintained that position. All he had to do now was turn the abilities that had made that possible partially toward his trial, and there was no doubt everything would turn out well. Above all, if he wanted to get anywhere, he had to reject the thought of any possible guilt right from the start. There was no guilt. The trial was no different than a major business deal of the sort he had often concluded advantageously for the bank, a deal in which, as was customary, various dangers lurked that must be avoided. To accomplish this, no notion of any sort of guilt dared be entertained, of course. All thought must be focused as clearly as possible on one's own advantage. From this point of view, it was also unavoidable that the lawyer be dismissed as soon as possible, preferably that very evening. It's true that was unheard of, according to his stories, and no doubt quite insulting, but Kay couldn't allow his own efforts in the case to run into hindrances that were perhaps occasioned by his own lawyer. Once he had shaken off his lawyer, however, he would need to submit the petition immediately, and to keep pressuring them, daily if possible, to consider it. To accomplish this, Kay would obviously have to do more than simply sit in the hall with the others and place his hat beneath the bench. He, or the women, or some other messengers, would have to besiege the officials day after day and force them to sit down at their desks and study Kay's petition, instead of staring through the grill into the hall. These efforts must be continuous, with everything organized and supervised. For once, the court was going to run into a defendant who knew how to stand up for his rights. But even though Kay felt he could handle all this, the difficulty of composing the petition was overwhelming. At one point, about a week ago, it was only with a sense of shame that he could even contemplate having to prepare such a petition some day. That it might be difficult had not even occurred to him. He recalled how one morning, when he was inundated with work, he had suddenly shoved everything aside and taken out his notepad to have a try at drafting the general outlines of such a petition, and perhaps making it available to his slow-witted lawyer, and how, at that very moment, the door of the head office had opened and the vice president had entered laughing heartily. That had been very embarrassing for Kay, even though the vice president was not, of course, laughing at the petition, of which he knew nothing, but at a stock market joke he'd just heard. A joke that could only be fully appreciated by means of a drawing, which, bending over Kay's desk and taking Kay's pencil from his hand, he sketched upon the notepad intended for the petition. Today, Kay no longer thought of shame. The petition had to be written. If he couldn't find time for it at the office, which was quite likely, he would have to do it nights at home. And if the nights weren't sufficient, he would have to take a leave of absence. Anything but stop halfway. That was the most senseless course of all, not only in business, but anywhere, at any time. Admittedly, the petition meant an almost endless task. One needn't be particularly faint of heart to be easily persuaded of the impossibility of ever finishing the petition. Not because of laziness or deceit, the only things that kept the lawyer from finishing, but because without knowing the nature of the charge and all its possible ramifications, his entire life, down to the smallest actions and events, would have to be called to mind, described, and examined from all sides. And what a sad job that was. Perhaps some day after retirement it might provide a suitable occupation for a mind turned childish, and help to while away the lengthening days. But now, when Kay needed all his wits for his work, when, given that he was still on the rise and already a threat to the vice president, every hour went speeding by, and when he wished to enjoy the brief evenings and nights as a young man, now he was supposed to start writing his petition. Once more his thoughts ended in lament. Almost involuntarily, simply to put an end to them, he felt for the button of the buzzer connected to the waiting room. As he pressed it, he looked up at the clock. It was 11 o'clock. He had been daydreaming for 2 hours, a long and valuable stretch of time, and was, of course, even wearier than before. Nevertheless, the time had not been wasted. He had reached decisions that might prove of value. Along with the assorted mail, the assistant brought in 2 business cards from gentlemen who had been waiting to see Kay for some time. They were, in fact, very important customers of the bank who should not have been left waiting on any account. Why had they shown up at such an inopportune time? And why, the gentleman seemed to respond in turn from behind the closed door, did the industrious Kay use prime business time for his private affairs? Tired from what he had already gone through, and tiredly awaiting what was yet to come, Kay rose to greet the first of them. He was a short, jovial gentleman, a manufacturer Kay knew well. He apologized for interrupting Kay in the midst of important work, while Kay apologized in turn for keeping the manufacturer waiting so long. But even this apology was delivered so mechanically and with such false emphasis that the manufacturer, had he not been entirely engrossed in the business at hand, would surely have noticed it. Instead, he hurriedly pulled figures and tables from every pocket, spread them before Kay, explained various entries, corrected a small error in the calculations that he'd caught in even this hasty survey, reminded Kay of a similar transaction he had concluded with him around a year ago, mentioned in passing that this time another bank was making great sacrifices to secure the deal, and finally fell silent to hear Kay's reaction. Kay had actually followed the manufacturer's explanations closely at first, and had been caught up by the thought of a major business deal, but unfortunately not for long. He soon stopped listening, nodded a while longer at the more emphatic exclamations of the manufacturer, but in the end abandoned even that, and limited himself to staring at the bald head bent over the papers, wondering when the manufacturer would finally realize that his entire presentation was in vain. As he now fell silent, Kay actually believed at first it was meant to give him an opportunity to confess he could no longer listen. But to his regret, he saw from the expectant gaze of the manufacturer, who was obviously prepared for any possible rejoinder, that the business conference was going to continue. So he ducked his head as if at an order and began moving his pencil back and forth above the papers, stopping here and there to stare at a number. The manufacturer sensed objections. Perhaps the figures weren't really firm, perhaps they weren't truly conclusive. In any case, the manufacturer placed his hand on the papers and, drawing right up against Kay, launched once more into a general description of the project. "It's complicated," Kay said, pursing his lips, and since the papers, the only thing he could grasp, were covered, he slumped against the arm of his chair. He glanced up only weakly, even when the door to the head office opened, and, somewhat blurred, as if behind a gauzy veil, the figure of the vice president appeared. Kay gave this no further thought, but simply observed the result, which pleased him greatly. For the manufacturer immediately jumped up from his chair and rushed toward the vice president. Kay would have had him move 10 times faster, however, for he feared the vice president might disappear. His fear was unwarranted. The gentlemen met, shook hands, and walked together toward Kay's desk. The manufacturer complained because the financial officer had shown so little inclination for the project, and pointed toward Kay, who, beneath the vice president's gaze, bent over the papers once more. As the two leaned against the desk, and the manufacturer now began to try to win over the vice president, it seemed to Kay as if the two men, whose size he mentally exaggerated, were negotiating with each other about him. Slowly he tried to ascertain, with cautiously upturned eyes, what was happening above him. Took one of the sheets of paper from the desk without looking at it, placed it on the palm of his hand, and lifted it at last to the men as he himself stood up. He had nothing particular in mind as he did so, but simply acted in the belief that he would have to behave thus when he finally prepared the grand petition that would totally exonerate him. The vice president, who had followed the conversation with the closest attention, simply glanced at the sheet, not even bothering to read it, since whatever was of importance to the financial officer was of no importance to him, took it from Kay's hand, said, "Thanks, I already know about it," and laid it back calmly on the desk. Kay gave him a bitter, sidelong glance. But the vice president didn't notice at all, or if he did notice, it only amused him. He laughed aloud several times, put the manufacturer at an obvious loss once with a shrewd reply, but quickly smoothed things over by raising an objection to his own position, and finally invited him to join him in his office, where they could bring the matter to a close. "It's a very important project," he said to the manufacturer. "I see that quite clearly. And our chief financial officer," even this remark was actually addressed only to the manufacturer, "will certainly be pleased if we take it off his hands. It's a matter that requires calm consideration, but he appears overburdened today, and a number of people have already been waiting hours for him in the outer office." Kay retained just enough self-control to turn away from the vice president and direct his friendly but rigid smile solely to the manufacturer. Otherwise he made no attempt to intervene, leaned forward slightly with both hands propped on his desk, like a clerk at his station, and looked on as the two men continued talking, picked up the papers from the desk, and disappeared into the head office. While still in the doorway, the manufacturer turned, said he wouldn't take his leave as yet, but would of course inform the financial officer of the outcome of the discussion, and that he still had one other small matter to mention to him. At last, Kay was alone. He had no intention of admitting any other clients, and he was only vaguely conscious of how pleasant it was that the people outside believed he was still dealing with the manufacturer, so that no one, not even his assistant, could enter. He went to the window, sat down on the broad sill, held on tightly to the handle with one hand, and looked out onto the square. The snow was still falling. The day had not yet brightened. He sat like that for a long time, without knowing what was actually troubling him, just glancing over his shoulder with a start from time to time at the door to the waiting room, where he mistakenly thought he heard a noise. But when no one arrived, he relaxed, went to the wash basin, washed his face with cold water, and returned to his place at the window with a clearer head. The decision to take charge of his own defense appeared more momentous now than he had originally assumed. So long as he had shifted the burden of his defense to his lawyer, the trial had not affected him all that much. He had observed it from afar and could scarcely be touched by it directly. He could check up on his case whenever he wished, but he could also pull his head back whenever he wanted to. Now, on the other hand, if he intended to undertake his own defense, he would have to expose himself fully to the court for the moment. The result would eventually be his full and definitive release, but in order to achieve this, he must temporarily place himself in far greater danger than before. If he had any doubts on that score, today's meeting with the vice president and the manufacturer offered ample proof. How could he have just sat there, totally paralyzed by the mere decision to defend himself? What would things be like later? The days that lay ahead, would he find the path that led through it all to a favorable end? Didn't a painstaking defense, and any other kind would be senseless, didn't a painstaking defense simultaneously imply the necessity of cutting himself off as far as possible from everything else? Would he successfully survive that? And how was he supposed to do that here at the bank? It wasn't just a matter of the petition, for which a leave might perhaps suffice, although requesting one just now would be taking a great chance. It was a matter of an entire trial, the length of which was unforeseeable. What an obstacle had suddenly been thrown in the path of Kay's career. And now he was expected to work for the bank? He glanced over at the desk. Now he was supposed to admit clients and deal with them? While his trial rolled on, while the officials of the court were up there in the attic going over the trial documents, he was supposed to conduct bank business? Didn't that seem like a form of torture, sanctioned by the court, a part of the trial itself accompanying it? And would anyone in the bank take his special situation into account when judging his work? No one, not ever. His trial was not entirely unknown, although it wasn't quite clear who knew about it and how much. He hoped, however, that the rumor had not yet reached the vice president. Otherwise there would have already been some clear sign of how, without the least regard for collegiality or common decency, he would use it against Kay. And the president? There was no doubt that he was favorably inclined toward Kay, and if he were to learn about the trial, he would probably try to make things easier for Kay as far as he could, but with little success, to be sure, since now that the counterweight Kay had offered up to this point was starting to weaken, he was falling increasingly under the influence of the vice president, who was also taking advantage of the president's precarious state of health to strengthen his own position. Then what hope was there for Kay? Perhaps he weakened his own resistance by such reflections, and yet it was also necessary to avoid self-deception and to see everything as clearly as possible at that moment. For no particular reason, simply to avoid returning to his desk for the time being, he opened the window. It was hard to open. He had to use both hands to turn the handle. Then fog, mingled with smoke, blew in through the window from top to bottom and filled the room with the faint smell of burning. A few flakes of snow drifted in as well. "A nasty autumn," the manufacturer said behind him, having entered the room unnoticed after leaving the vice president. Kay nodded and looked nervously at the manufacturer's briefcase, from which he would now no doubt pull the papers to report the results of his discussion with the vice president. The manufacturer, however, followed Kay's gaze, tapped his briefcase, and said, without opening it, "You want to hear how it turned out? Not too badly. I've practically got a signed contract in my pocket. Charming man, your vice president, but not without his dangerous side." He laughed, shook Kay's hand, and tried to get him to laugh as well. But now it struck Kay as suspicious that the manufacturer didn't want to show him the papers, and he found nothing in the manufacturer's remarks to laugh about. "My dear sir," said the manufacturer, "you're probably suffering from the weather. You look so dejected today." "Yes," said Kay, and pressed his hand to his forehead. "A headache, family problems." "Yes, indeed," said the manufacturer, who was always in a hurry and could listen to no one patiently. "Each of us has his cross to bear." Kay had instinctively taken a step toward the door, as if he wished to see the manufacturer out, but the latter said, "I had one other small matter to mention, my dear sir. I'm afraid I may perhaps be adding to your burdens today with this, but I've already been here twice in the recent past and forgot it both times. If I put it off any longer, it will probably lose its point altogether. But that would be too bad, since my information is perhaps not entirely without value." Before Kay had time to reply, the manufacturer stepped up close to him, tapped him on the chest with his knuckle, and said quietly, "You're involved in a trial, right?" Kay stepped back and exclaimed at once, "The vice president told you that?" "Oh, no," said the manufacturer. "How would the vice president know?" "And you?" asked Kay, immediately calmer. "I find out things about the court now and then," said the manufacturer, "such as the information I wanted to pass on to you." "So many people are connected with the court," said Kay, with bowed head, and led the manufacturer over to the desk. They sat down again, as before, and the manufacturer said, "I don't have much information to offer, unfortunately, but you shouldn't neglect even the smallest item in these matters, and I feel an urge to help you somehow, no matter how modest that help might be. We've been good business friends up to now, haven't we? Well then." Kay started to beg his pardon for the way he had behaved at that day's conference, but the manufacturer would not be interrupted. He shoved his briefcase high under his arm to show he was in a hurry and went on, "I know about your trial from a certain Titorelli. He's a painter. Titorelli is just the name he goes by as an artist. I don't know his real one. He's been coming to my office off and on for years, bringing small paintings for which I always give him a sort of alms. He's almost a beggar. They're pretty pictures, by the way, landscapes of heaths and the like. These sales, we're both long since used to them, go smoothly enough. But at one point he started repeating his visits too often. I raised objections. We started talking. I was interested in how he managed to support himself on his art alone, and learned, to my astonishment, that his major source of income was portrait painting. He said he worked for the court. For which court?" I asked. And then he told me about the court. You can no doubt well imagine how astonished I was at his stories. Since then, whenever he visits, I hear some item of news about the court, and so I've gradually gained a certain insight into the matter. Of course, Titorelli gossips a lot, and I often have to turn him off, not simply because he surely lies as well, but above all because a businessman like myself, almost collapsing beneath the burdens of his own affairs, can't spend too much time worrying about those of others. But that's beside the point. Perhaps, it occurred to me now, Titorelli could be of some help to you. He knows several judges, and even if he doesn't have much influence himself, he could still advise you on how to gain access to various influential people. And even if this sort of advice is not in and of itself crucial, in my opinion it might take on great importance in your possession. After all, you're practically a lawyer. I always say, Chief Financial Officer Kay is practically a lawyer. Oh, I have no worries about your trial. But would you like to visit Titorelli? With my recommendation, he'll certainly try to do everything he can. I really think you should go. Doesn't have to be today, of course, sometime or other, at your convenience. Of course, let me add this, you mustn't feel obliged to actually visit Titorelli just because I'm the one who advised you to do so. No. If you think you can get along without him, it would be better to leave him out of it entirely. Perhaps you already have some precise plan Titorelli might disturb. Then no, you most assuredly shouldn't go. A person is naturally reluctant to allow himself to be advised by a fellow like that. As you wish, then. Here's the letter of introduction, and here's the address. Disappointed, Kay took the letter and stuck it in his pocket. Even in the most favourable of cases, any advantage he might gain from the recommendation was small compared to the harm that lay in the fact that the manufacturer knew about his trial and that the painter was spreading the news about. He could hardly force himself to offer a few words of thanks to the manufacturer, who was already on his way to the door. "I'll go there," he said, as he saw the manufacturer off at the door, "or, since I'm so busy right now, I'll write to say he should come to my office sometime." "I knew you'd figure out how best to handle it," said the manufacturer. "Of course, I thought you'd prefer to avoid inviting people like this Titorelli to the bank to discuss your trial. It's not always a good idea to send letters to such people either. But you've no doubt thought everything over carefully and know what to do." Kay nodded and accompanied the manufacturer on through the waiting room. In spite of his calm exterior, he was shocked at himself. He'd only said he would write to Titorelli to show the manufacturer that he appreciated his recommendation and that he would seriously consider the possibility of getting together with Titorelli. But if he had thought that Titorelli's assistance might be of use, he would not have hesitated to actually write to him. The resulting danger, however, had not occurred to him until the manufacturer made his remark. Could he really rely so little on his own judgment already? If he could allow himself to send an explicit letter of invitation to a man of questionable character to come to the bank in order, separated only by a door from the vice president, to seek his advice on his trial, was it not possible, and even probable, that he was overlooking other dangers or heading straight for them? There wouldn't always be someone standing at his side to warn him. And now, of all times, when he should be gathering all his strength to act, previously unknown doubts about his own judgment had to arise. Were the difficulties he was having carrying out his office work going to begin in his trial as well? Certainly now he no longer understood how he could ever have considered writing to Titorelli and inviting him to the bank. He was still shaking his head about it when the assistant stepped up beside him and pointed out three gentlemen sitting there in the outer room on a bench. They had been waiting to see Kay for some time. Now that the assistant was speaking to Kay, they stood up, each seeking a favourable opportunity to approach Kay before the others. Since the bank had been inconsiderate enough to waste their time in the waiting room, they were not about to show any further consideration themselves. "Sir," one of them was saying, but Kay had asked the assistant to bring him his winter coat, and, as the assistant helped him on with it, said to all three, "Pardon me, gentlemen, but unfortunately I have no time to receive you now. I do beg your pardon, but I have an urgent business errand to attend to and have to leave immediately. You see how long I've been tied up. Would you be so kind as to come again tomorrow or some other time? Or could we possibly handle the matter by phone? Or could you tell me briefly now what it is you wanted, and I'll give you a full reply in writing? Of course, the best thing would be to come again soon." Kay's suggestion so astonished the gentlemen, who had evidently waited entirely in vain, that they stared at each other in total speechlessness. "It's settled, then?" asked Kay, turning to the assistant, who now brought him his hat as well. Through the open door of Kay's office one could see that the snow was falling much more heavily outside. Therefore Kay turned up his coat collar and buttoned it up to his neck. Just at that moment the vice president stepped out of the adjoining room, smiled as he saw Kay in his winter coat conferring with the men, and asked, "Are you on your way out, Herr Kay?"
"Yes," said Kay, drawing himself up.
"I have a business errand to attend to." But the vice president had already turned to the other men. "And these gentlemen," he asked, "I believe they've been waiting a long time."
"We've already worked that out," said Kay.
But now the men could be held back no longer. They surrounded Kay and declared that they wouldn't have waited all these hours if they hadn't had important business that needed to be discussed at once, in detail and privately, person to person. The vice president listened to them for a while, regarded Kay, who held his hat in his hand and was wiping a few spots of dust off it, and then said, "Gentlemen, there's a simple solution. If you'll be kind enough to come along with me, I will gladly confer with you in place of the financial officer. Of course, your business must be discussed at once. We're businessmen like yourselves, and we know how valuable a businessman's time is. Won't you come in?" And he opened the door that led into the waiting room of his office. How good the vice president was at appropriating everything Kay was forced to relinquish. But wasn't Kay relinquishing more than was really necessary? While he was running off to an unknown painter with vague and, he must admit, quite slender hopes, his reputation here was suffering irreparable damage. It would probably have been much better to remove his winter coat and try to win back at least the two gentlemen who were still waiting in the next room. And Kay might have tried to do so had he not seen the vice president in his own office searching through the bookcase as if it were his own. As Kay approached the door in agitation, the vice president exclaimed, "Oh, you haven't left yet." He turned his face toward him, its many deeply scored lines seeming to signal strength rather than age, and immediately renewed his search. "I was looking for a copy of a contract," he said, "that the firm's representative says you're supposed to have. Won't you help me look?" Kay took a step, but the vice president said, "Oh, thanks, I've just found it," and turned back into his office with a thick stack of documents that obviously contained much more than just the copy of the contract. "I'm no match for him at the moment," Kay said to himself, "but once I've dispensed with my personal difficulties, he's going to get it, and get it good." Somewhat comforted by this thought, Kay instructed the assistant, who had been holding the hall door open for him for some time, to inform the president when he got the chance that he was out on a business errand, then left the bank, almost happy to be able to devote himself totally to his case for a while. He drove at once to the painter, who lived in a suburb that lay in a completely opposite direction from the one with the law court offices. It was an even poorer neighbourhood. The buildings were darker, the narrow streets filled with filth, floating slowly about on the melting snow. In the building where the painter lived, only one wing of the great double door stood open. At the bottom of the other wing, however, near the wall, there was a gaping hole from which, just as Kay approached, a disgusting steaming yellow fluid poured forth, before which a rat fled into the nearby sewer. At the bottom of the steps, a small child was lying face down on the ground, crying, but it could hardly be heard above the noise coming from a sheet-metal shop beyond the entranceway. The door of the workshop stood open. Three workers were standing around some object in a half-circle, beating on it with hammers. A great sheet of tin hanging on the wall cast a pale shimmer that flowed between two workers, illuminating their faces and work aprons. Kay merely glanced at all this. He wanted to finish up here as fast as possible, just see what he could learn from the painter with a few words and go straight back to the bank. If he had even the slightest success here, it would still have a good effect on that day's work at the bank. On the third floor, he was forced to slow his pace. He was completely out of breath. The steps were unusually high and the flights unusually long, and the painter supposedly lived right at the top in an attic room. The air was oppressive as well. There was no stairwell. The narrow stairs were closed in on both sides by walls, with only a few small windows here and there, high up, near the ceiling. Just as Kay paused for a moment, a few little girls ran out of an apartment and rushed on up the stairs, laughing. Kay followed them slowly, caught up with one of the girls who had stumbled and remained behind the others, and asked, as they continued to climb the stairs together, "Does a painter named Titorelli live here?" The girl, 13 at most, and somewhat hunchbacked, poked him with her elbow and peered up at him sideways. Neither her youth nor her deformity had prevented her early corruption. She didn't even smile, but instead stared boldly and invitingly at Kay. Ignoring her behaviour, Kay asked, "Do you know the painter Titorelli?" She nodded and asked in turn,
"What do you want with him?"
Kay thought it would be to his advantage to pick up a little quick knowledge about Titorelli. "I want him to paint my portrait," he said.
"Paint your portrait?"
she asked, opening her mouth wide and pushing Kay lightly with her hand, as if he had said something extraordinarily surprising or gauche. Then she lifted her little skirt, which was extremely short to begin with both hands, and ran as fast as she could after the other girls, whose cries were already disappearing indistinctly above. At the very next landing, however, Kay met up with all the girls again. They had evidently been informed of Kay's intentions by the hunchback and were waiting for him. They stood on both sides of the steps, pressed themselves against the wall so that Kay could pass comfortably between them, and smoothed their smocks with their hands. Their faces, as well as the guard of honour they formed, conveyed a mixture of childishness and depravity. Above, at the head of the group of girls, who now closed around Kay laughingly, was the hunchback, who took over the lead. It was thanks to her that Kay found his way so easily. He had intended to go straight on up the stairs, but she showed him he had to take a stairway off to the side to reach Titorelli. The stairway that led to him was particularly narrow, extremely long, without a turn, visible along its entire length, and ended directly at Titorelli's door.
This door, which compared to the rest of the stairway was relatively well illuminated by a small skylight set at an angle above it, was constructed of unfinished boards, upon which the name Titorelli was painted in red with broad brushstrokes. Kay was barely halfway up the stairs with his retinue when the door above them opened slightly, apparently in response to the sound of all the feet, and a man appeared in the crack of the door, seemingly dressed only in his nightshirt. "Oh!" he cried as he saw the crowd approaching, and disappeared. The hunchback clapped her hands with joy, and the rest of the girls pushed behind Kay to hurry him along. They weren't even all the way up yet, however, when the painter flung the door wide open and with a deep bow invited Kay to enter. The girls, on the other hand, he fended off. He wouldn't let a single one in, no matter how much they begged, no matter how hard they tried to push their way in, if not with his permission, then against his will. Only the hunchback managed to slip under his outstretched arm, but the painter raced after her, seized her by the skirts, whirled her once around him, and then set her back down in front of the door with the other girls, who had not dared cross the threshold when the painter abandoned his post. Kay didn't know how to judge all this. It looked as if the whole thing was happening on friendly terms. The girls by the door craned their necks one after the other, called out various humorously intended remarks to the painter that Kay couldn't catch, and the painter laughed as well while the hunchback almost flew in his hands. Then he shut the door, bowed to Kay again, held out his hand and introduced himself. "I'm Titorelli, the artist." Kay pointed to the door behind which the girls were whispering and said, "You seem very popular here in the building." "Oh, those brats," said the painter, and tried in vain to button his nightshirt around his neck. He was barefoot as well, and otherwise wore nothing but a pair of roomy yellow linen trousers tied with a belt whose long end dangled loosely. "Those brats are a real burden to me," he went on, giving up on his nightshirt, the last button of which had now come off, and fetching a chair on which he made Kay sit. "I painted one of them once. She isn't even here today, and they've been pestering me ever since. If I'm here, they only come in when I let them. But if I go away, there's always at least one of them here. They've had a key made to my door and lend it to each other. You can't imagine how annoying that is. For instance, I come home with a lady I'm supposed to paint, open the door with my key, and find, let's say, the hunchback sitting at the little table there, painting her lips red with the brush, while her little sisters, the ones she's supposed to be watching, wander around making a mess in every corner of the room. Or, as happened only yesterday, I come home late at night, in light of which I hope you'll pardon my state and the disorder of the room, I come home late at night and start to get in bed when something pinches my leg. I look under the bed and pull out another one. Why they push themselves on me so, I don't know. You'll have noticed yourself that I don't try to lure them in. Of course, they disturb my work, too. If this atelier weren't provided for me free, I would have moved out long ago." Just then a small voice called from behind the door, softly and timidly.
"Titorelli, can we come in yet?"
"No," answered the painter.
"Not even just me?"
it asked again. "Not even you," said the painter, walking over to the door and locking it. In the meantime, Kay had been looking around the room. He would never have imagined that anyone could refer to this miserable little room as an atelier. You could scarcely take two long strides in any direction. Everything was made of wood, the floor, the walls, the ceiling. You could see narrow cracks between the boards. A bed stood against the wall across from Kay, piled high with bedding of various colours. On an easel in the middle of the room stood a painting covered by a shirt with its arms dangling to the floor. Behind Kay was the window, through which one could see no farther in the fog than the snow-covered roof of the neighbouring building. The key turning in the lock reminded Kay that he had intended to stay only a short while, so he pulled the manufacturer's letter from his pocket, handed it to the painter, and said, "I learned about you from this gentleman, whom you know, and I've come at his suggestion." The painter skimmed through the letter and tossed it onto the bed. Had the manufacturer not clearly spoken of Titorelli as someone he knew, a poor man dependent upon his alms, one might have easily believed Titorelli had no idea who the manufacturer was, or at any rate couldn't recall him. Moreover, the painter now asked, "Do you wish to buy paintings or to have your portrait painted?" Kay looked at the painter in amazement. What was in that letter? Kay had taken it for granted that the manufacturer's letter informed the painter that Kay wished only to inquire about his trial. He had rushed over too quickly, without thinking. But now he had to give the painter some sort of answer, so he said, with a glance at the easel, "Are you working on a painting now?" "Yes," said the painter, and tossed the shirt that was hanging over the easel onto the bed alongside the letter. "It's a portrait. A nice job, but it's not quite finished yet." Luck was on Kay's side.
The opportunity to talk about the court was being handed to him on a platter, for it was clearly the portrait of a judge. Moreover, it was strikingly similar to the painting in the lawyer's study. Of course, this was a completely different judge, a fat man with a black bushy beard that hung far down the sides of his cheeks, and that had been an oil painting, while this was faintly and indistinctly sketched in pastel. But everything else was similar, for here, too, the judge was about to rise up threateningly from his throne, gripping its arms. "That must be a judge," Kay started to say, but then held back for a moment and approached the picture as if he wanted to study it in detail. He was unable to interpret a large figure centred atop the back of the throne and asked the painter about it. "I still have some work to do on it," answered the painter, taking a pastel crayon from the little table and adding a few strokes to the contours of the figure, without, however, making it any clearer to Kay in the process. "It's the figure of justice," the painter finally said. "Now I recognize it," said Kay. "There's the blindfold over her eyes, and here are the scales. But are those wings on her heels, and isn't she in motion?" "Yes," said the painter. "I'm commissioned to do it that way. It's actually justice and the goddess of victory in one." "Well, that's a poor combination," said Kay, smiling. "Justice must remain at rest, otherwise the scales sway and no just judgment is possible." "I'm just following the wishes of the person who commissioned it," said the painter. "Yes, of course," said Kay, who hadn't meant to hurt anyone's feelings by his remark. "You've painted the figure the way it actually appears on the throne." "No," said the painter. "I've seen neither the figure nor the chair of state. That's all an invention. But I was told what to paint." "What do you mean?" asked Kay, intentionally acting as if he didn't really understand the painter. "Well, that's surely a judge sitting in a judge's chair." "Yes," said the painter. "But it's not a high judge, and he hasn't ever sat in a throne like that." "And yet he allows himself to be portrayed in such a solemn pose. He's sitting there like the president of the court." "Yes, the gentlemen are vain," said the painter, "but they have higher permission to be painted that way. There are precise instructions as to how each of them may be portrayed, but unfortunately it's impossible to judge the details of his attire and the chair in this picture. Pastels aren't really suitable for these portraits." "Yes," said Kay. "It's strange that it's done in pastel." "The judge wanted it that way," said the painter. "It's intended for a lady." Looking at the painting seemed to have made him want to work on it. He rolled up the sleeves of his nightshirt, picked up a few pastels, and Kay watched as, beneath the trembling tips of the crayons, a reddish shadow took shape around the judge's head and extended outward in rays toward the edges of the picture. Gradually this play of shadow surrounded the head like an ornament or a sign of high distinction. But, except for an imperceptible shading, brightness still surrounded the figure of justice, and in this brightness the figure seemed to stand out strikingly. Now it scarcely recalled the goddess of justice, or even that of victory. Now it looked just like the goddess of the hunt. The painter's work attracted Kay more than he wished. At last, however, he reproached himself for having been there so long without having really undertaken anything for his own case. "What's the name of this judge?" he asked suddenly. "I'm not allowed to say," replied the painter. He was bent low over the painting and pointedly ignoring his guest, whom he had at first received so courteously. Kay assumed this was a passing mood and was annoyed because it was causing him to lose time. "I take it you're a confidant of the court?" he asked. The painter laid aside his pastels at once, straightened up, rubbed his hands together, and looked at Kay with a smile. "Just come straight out with the truth," he said. "You want to learn something about the court, as it says in your letter of introduction, and you discussed my paintings first to win me over. But I don't hold that against you. You had no way of knowing that doesn't work with me." "Oh, come on," he said sharply as Kay tried to object, and then continued. "By the way, your remark was quite accurate. I am a confidant of the court." He paused as if to allow Kay time to come to terms with this fact. Now the girls could be heard again behind the door. They were probably crowding around the keyhole. Perhaps they could see in through the cracks as well. Kay made no attempt to excuse himself, not wishing to sidetrack the painter. But neither did he wish the painter to become too arrogant and move, as it were, beyond his reach. So he asked, "Is that an officially recognized position?" "No," said the painter curtly, as if that was all he had to say about it. But Kay had no wish to see him fall silent and said, "Well, such unofficial positions often carry more influence than ones that are recognized." "That's how it is with mine," said the painter, and nodded with a frown.
I discussed your case yesterday with the manufacturer. He asked me whether I would be willing to help you. I replied, "The man can come see me sometime, and I'm pleased to see you here so soon. You seem to be taking the affair to heart, which doesn't surprise me in the least, of course. But wouldn't you like to take your coat off?" Although Kay intended to stay for only a short while, the painter's suggestion was quite welcome. The air in the room had gradually become oppressive. He had glanced over several times at a small and obviously unlit iron stove in the corner. The closeness in the room was inexplicable. As he took off his winter coat and then unbuttoned his jacket as well, the painter said apologetically, "I have to keep it warm. It's cozy in here, isn't it? The room is well situated in that respect." Kay did not reply to this, but actually it wasn't the warmth that made him uncomfortable. It was the muggy atmosphere that rendered breathing difficult. The room probably hadn't been aired for ages. This unpleasantness was intensified for Kay by the fact that the painter had him sit on the bed while he himself sat before the easel in the only chair in the room. Moreover, the painter seemed to misunderstand Kay's reason for remaining perched on the edge of the bed. He even told Kay to make himself comfortable, and, when Kay hesitated, he walked over and pressed him deep into the bedding and pillows. Then he returned to his chair and finally asked his first factual question, which made Kay forget everything else. "Are you innocent?" he asked. "Yes," said Kay. Answering this question was a positive pleasure, particularly since he was making the statement to a private citizen and thus bore no true responsibility. No one had ever asked him so openly. To savour this pleasure to the full, he added, "I am totally innocent." "Well, then," said the painter, bowing his head and apparently considering this. Suddenly he lifted his head again and said, "If you're innocent, then the matter is really quite simple." Kay's face clouded over. This so-called confidant of the court was talking like an ignorant child. "My innocence doesn't simplify the matter," said Kay. He had to smile in spite of himself and shook his head slowly. "A number of subtle points are involved in which the court loses its way, but then in the end it pulls out some profound guilt from somewhere where there was originally none at all." "Yes, yes, of course," said the painter, as if Kay were needlessly interrupting his train of thought. "But you are innocent." "Well, yes," said Kay. "That's the main thing," said the painter. He couldn't be swayed by counter-arguments, but in spite of his decisiveness, it wasn't clear whether he was speaking from conviction or indifference. Kay wanted to determine that first, and so he said, "You certainly know the court much better than I do. I don't know much more about it than what I've heard, from all sorts of people, of course. But they're all in agreement that charges are never made frivolously, and that the court, once it brings a charge, is convinced of the guilt of the accused, and that it is difficult to sway them from this conviction." "Difficult?" asked the painter, throwing one hand in the air. "The court can never be swayed from it. If I were to paint all the judges in a row on this canvas and you were to plead your case before them, you would have more success than before the actual court." "Yes," said Kay to himself, forgetting that he had only intended to sound out the painter. Behind the door, a girl started asking again,
"Titterelli, isn't he going to leave pretty soon?"
"Quiet," the painter yelled at the door. "Can't you see that I'm having a conference with this gentleman?" But that didn't satisfy the girl, who instead asked,
"Are you going to paint him?"
And when the painter didn't reply, she added,
"Please don't paint him. He's so ugly."
A confusion of unintelligible cries of agreement followed. The painter sprang to the door, opened it a crack. The clasped hands of the girls could be seen stretched out imploringly, and said,
"If you don't be quiet, I'm going to throw you all down the stairs. Sit down on the steps and keep still." Apparently they didn't obey right away, so that he had to make it a command. "Down on the steps!" Only then was it quiet.
"Pardon me," said the painter, turning to Kay again.
Kay had scarcely glanced toward the door. He'd left it entirely up to the painter whether and how he was to be protected. Even now he hardly moved as the painter bent down to him and, in order not to be heard outside, whispered in his ear, "Those girls belong to the court as well."
"What?"
asked Kay, jerking his head away and staring at the painter. But the latter sat down in his chair again and said, half in jest, half in explanation, "Everything belongs to the court."
"I hadn't noticed that," Kay said curtly.
The painter's general statement stripped the reference to the girls of any disturbing quality. Even so, Kay gazed for a while at the door, behind which the girls were now sitting quietly on the steps.
Only one had poked a piece of straw through a crack between the boards and was moving it slowly up and down.
"You don't seem to have a general overview of the court yet," said the painter.
He had spread his legs wide and was tapping his toes on the floor. "But since you're innocent, you won't need one. I'll get you off on my own."
"How are you going to do that?" asked Kay. "You said yourself just a moment ago that the court is entirely impervious to proof."
"Impervious only to proof brought before the court," said the painter, and lifted his forefinger as if Kay had missed a subtle distinction. "But it's another matter when it comes to behind-the-scene efforts in the conference rooms, in the corridors, or, for example, even here in the atelier." What the painter now said seemed less improbable to Kay. On the contrary, it stood in close agreement with what Kay had heard from others as well. Yes, it was even filled with hope. If the judges could really be swayed as easily through personal contacts as the lawyer had suggested, then the painter's contacts with vain judges were particularly important and should by no means be underestimated. The painter would fit perfectly into the circle of helpers Kay was gradually assembling about him. His organizational talents had once been highly praised at the bank. Here, where he was entirely on his own, he had an excellent opportunity to test them to the full. The painter observed the effect of his explanation on Kay, and then asked with a certain anxiety, "Have you noticed I sound almost like a lawyer? It's constantly interacting with gentlemen of the court that influences me. Of course, I profit greatly from it, but I tend to lose a good deal of artistic energy." "How did you first come in contact with the judges?" asked Kay. He wanted to win the painter's confidence before directly enlisting his aid. "Well, that was quite simple," said the painter. "I inherited the connection. My father himself was a court painter. It's one post that's always hereditary. New people are of no use for it. The rules for painting the various levels of officials are so numerous, so varied, and above all so secret, that they simply aren't known beyond certain families. There in that drawer, for example, I have my father's notes, which I show to no one. But only someone who knows them is equipped to paint the judges. Nevertheless, even if I were to lose them, I still carry so many rules in my head that no one could ever dispute my right to the post. Every judge wants to be painted like the great judges of old, and only I can do that." "That's an enviable situation," said Kay, who was thinking about his own position in the bank. "So your position is unshakable?" "Yes, unshakable," said the painter, proudly lifting his shoulders. "And that allows me to take a chance now and then, helping a poor man with his trial."
"And how do you do that?" asked Kay, as if he were not the one the painter had just called a poor man. But the painter wouldn't be sidetracked, saying instead, "In your case, for example, since you're entirely innocent, I plan to undertake the following." This repeated reference to his innocence was beginning to annoy Kay. At times it seemed to him as if, by such remarks, the painter was insisting upon a favourable outcome to the trial as a precondition for his help, which thus amounted to nothing on its own, of course. But in spite of these doubts, Kay controlled himself and didn't interrupt the painter. He didn't want to do without the painter's help, he was sure of that, and that help seemed no more questionable than the lawyer's. In fact, Kay far preferred the former, because it was offered more simply and openly. The painter had pulled his chair closer to the bed and continued in a low voice, "I forgot to ask first what sort of release you want. There are three possibilities: actual acquittal, apparent acquittal, and protraction. Actual acquittal is best, of course, but I don't have the slightest influence on that particular result. In my opinion, there's not a single person anywhere who could have an influence on an actual acquittal. In that case, the defendant's innocence alone is probably decisive. Since you're innocent, it would actually be possible to rely on your innocence alone, but then you wouldn't need help from me or anyone else." This orderly presentation took Kay aback at first, but then he said, as quietly as the painter, "I think you're contradicting yourself." "How?" the painter asked patiently and leaned back with a smile. This smile made Kay feel as if he were trying to reveal contradictions not so much in the words of the painter as in the legal process itself. Nevertheless, he did not retreat, but said, "You remarked earlier that the court is impervious to proof. Later, you restricted this to the public aspect of the court, and now you even claim that an innocent man needs no help at all before the court. That's a contradiction in itself. Moreover, you also stated earlier that judges can be personally influenced, although you now deny that an actual acquittal, as you call it, can ever be achieved through personal influence. That's a second contradiction." "Well, these contradictions can be easily explained," said the painter.
We're talking about two different things here, what the law says and what I've experienced personally. You mustn't confuse the two. In the law, which I've never read, mind you, it says, of course, on the one hand, that an innocent person is to be acquitted. On the other hand, it does not say that judges can be influenced. My own experience, however, has been precisely the opposite. I know of no actual acquittals, but know many instances of influence. Of course, it's possible that in the cases I'm familiar with, no one was ever innocent. But doesn't that seem unlikely? In all those cases, not one single innocent person? Even as a child, I listened closely to my father when he talked about trials at home, and the judges who came to his atelier discussed the court as well. In our circles, no one talked of anything else. From the moment I was allowed to go to court, I attended constantly, heard the crucial stages of innumerable trials, followed them insofar as they could be followed, and, I must admit, I never saw a single actual acquittal. "Not a single acquittal, then," said Kay, as if speaking to himself and to his hopes. "That confirms the opinion I've already formed of this court. So it has no real point in that respect, either. A single hangman could replace the entire court." "You mustn't generalize," said the painter, displeased. "I've spoken only of my own experience." "That's quite enough," said Kay. "Or have you heard of acquittals in earlier times?" "Such acquittals are said to have occurred, of course," said the painter, "but that's extremely difficult to determine. The final verdicts of the court are not published, and not even the judges have access to them. Thus only legends remain about ancient court cases. These tell of actual acquittals, of course, even in a majority of cases. You can believe them, but they can't be proved true. Nevertheless, they shouldn't be entirely ignored. They surely contain a certain degree of truth, and they are very beautiful. I myself have painted a few pictures based on such legends." "Mere legends can't change my opinion," said Kay. "I assume these legends can't be cited in court." The painter laughed. "No, they can't," he said. "Then it's useless talking about them," said Kay. He was accepting all the painter's opinions for the time being, even if he considered them improbable and they contradicted other reports. He didn't have time right now to examine the truth of everything the painter said, let alone to disprove it. The best he could hope for was to induce the painter to help him somehow, even if it was not in any crucial way. So he said, "Let's leave actual acquittal aside, then. You mentioned two further possibilities." "Apparent acquittal and protraction. It can only be one of those two," said the painter. "But don't you want to take off your jacket before we discuss them? You must be hot."
This book is continued on Disc 5.